Welcome to Reconstructed Faith, a podcast where we talk about truth you can build your life on. We hope to dive into the hard conversations of life and faith and seek out reasonable, substantive answers. My name is Colson Lechner, and I am joined by Chris Legg and Brent Starnes. This is Reconstructed Faith.
Hey there, Colson Lechner here, and welcome back to Reconstructed Faith. If you've been with us for a while, thanks for sticking around. We're really grateful for those of you who tune in whenever new episodes drop. We've got more conversations coming your way, ones we hope will encourage you and challenge you to think a little deeper about your faith. So with that said, let's get into today's conversation.
Well, welcome back to the Reconstructed Faith podcast. My name is Colson Lechner. I'm your host, and I'm joined, as always, by my partners in crime, Chris Legg and Bryn Starnes.
Well done.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's the little things, getting those names right.
That's exactly right.
I just had a 33rd birthday. I'm getting up there.
That's all right. Yeah, you're one foot in the grave.
That's right. Friend. That's right.
So happy belated birthday. I'm old enough to be your dad.
Oh. My dad just turned 60.
Yeah. So he's got 7 years on me, but
yeah, there you go.
Technically, if I'd started really early.
Yeah. Well, one of our church members, Joe Greco, said, he said, you're considered an old fart when you hit 60.
There
Before
you go.
That, very you're good. Not. My favorite is Chris.
Does that require an explicit now? Do we have to have an explicit on
maybe,
this episode?
Yeah, maybe bleep it out.
Yeah, I'm going to have to bleep that out.
Oh, yeah, we'll just put it on there. No, Chris.
You're listening with children.
I never know. Yeah, that's very true. I never know, though. Like, so Chris has said, and it might have even been on this podcast. He's like, I'm at the age where if I die now, it's not a tragedy.
That's exactly right. It's no longer a tragedy.
It's not a tragedy.
But you didn't live like a long life. What was it? So you're like,
it's not yet to the place probably where people would be like, he had a good run.
Yeah.
He had a long life. Like he had it's not going to have that.
But it's not
so tragic. Yeah. It's no longer tragic.
Like, it's a sweet spot.
I feel like you're at the age where it would still be tragic, Colson.
Yeah. Oh, it'd still be tragic for Colson.
Absolutely. But I don't think it's because of me. I think it's because of my children.
For sure. Absolutely. That plays into it for sure. Yeah. It would definitely be tragic for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then your wife could try again to have a better marriage this time around.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. That goes without saying. Yeah,
exactly.
I'd only, comment on that, but
only
she
up
doesn't
from here.
Listen
exactly.
to the podcast.
Same. That's exactly right.
Anyway.
In good shape.
Oh, well, today, you know, we're starting out the new year here. I'm behind on posting stuff, but we're going to be posting some interviews and stuff and some, different listener questions, different commentaries and stuff going on. But today we're going to talk about the Shroud of Turin.
Oh, I know.
I feel like that word, those words, kind of Shroud of Turin just kind of feels like intense.
It does. The word Shroud alone is just like really cool.
It sounds like
an Indiana Jones episode.
Well, I didn't
know
what it was. And then I looked it up. And I was like, oh.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Indiana Jones on the Shroud of Turin.
Exactly.
It doesn't sound real. That's for sure.
That's right.
Well, it's good. Well, here's the thing. It'll probably be on some like Angel Studios. We'll do the next one.
That's right. Perfect.
Okay. We're talking about the Shroud of Turin. And as we were talking about it a little bit, Chris said, I've been with this.
I've
from
gotten
the
to live through it.
Down.
Yes.
So before we kind of converse about it, if you're thinking over there in podcast world, I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
Can you unpack real quick?
Yes.
What is the Shroud of Turin?
Okay. So I was there in 1354. No, I'm going that far back.
He's a vampire.
But here's what I will tell you. As a kid, it kind of came out into the public in the 70s and 80s as like a new big thing. But the reason, so it's been around for a long time. It's this shroud. It's a shroud because it was laid over a dead person's body, allegedly.
Like right? A cloth.
It's a cloth. It's a piece of fabric that was laid across a dead person's body, allegedly. Now, the debate over the years has always been, is it a work of art? Did someone intentionally create this? Or was it laid over a dead body? If it was laid over a dead body, was that dead body Jesus of Nazareth? So that's really the debate that's been going on, right? And so, well, I was around and was thought was interesting as a kid, knew it existed. It's kind of had this kind of Roman Catholic feel, like a relic type thing that they get excited about. And so it was like, is this real? Is it not? You know, growing up with scientists and skeptics and that kind of stuff, it was kind of like, meh, probably not. It's too perfect and whatever. And so I was alive and a young person when the research was done on it in the 80s and then even later in the 90s and whatever. when it was essentially debunked. It's like, no, this is not real. We've carbon dated it. It turns out it's only a few hundred years old. It's not a few thousand years old. And all of that research, we'll talk about this in a minute.
Oh yeah.
But that's all great. The research came out and it was,
and that's in the '80s.
In the '80s.
Okay.
And it was like, no, turns out it's just a work of art, which is actually what some very early writers said. It was not real. It was a work of art. And it was not supposed, it was not actually a relic. It was a piece of art. It was an icon. And done, dunsies, like we're all done, all good. Well, not so much. In the last few years, new research techniques, new ways of studying this piece of fabric have revealed that it actually almost certainly is from the first century. And man, it is really crazy stuff. And so when people started first coming back with it, I kind of had that same eye roll thing I do, like, oh, it's been 20 years. It's time for werewolf movies to come back. Mm-hmm. Like, it's been another 20 years. Must be time for zombies. Like these things just kind of rotate through. Oh, because it's about time. Like, let's, you know, we'll count off sometime next
time
5 years.
Somebody's going to zombies and wide leg jeans.
That's exactly right. Wide legged jeans and tennis shoes. I mean,
but it's like somebody's
bad.
Right. And the end of the world is about to happen again.
We're going to rediscover the red heifer and the book of Judas. It's about time for people to discover the book of Judas and the apocryphal gospels again and the Gnostic gospels. Like,
yeah,
it's about that time for a bit to be like, what? Where did these come from? Well, people have been hiding this from us for 2,000 years. Like, no, I mean, there's literally Time magazine copies written 20 years. Every 20 years that the world rediscovers these things. And I was like, oh, we've rediscovered the Shroud of Turin. Mm-hmm.
Big whoop.
Yeah. Okay. And so, yeah. But I actually think there's something to it this time. So I've been having fun.
Wow.
We had a listener ask about
it,
but I've now lived through one cycle of the ups and downs of the Shroud of Turin. And so now here's what I will say. You do have to do some good research because there are people out there saying stuff that isn't right or that they're greatly overstating it.
Well, and that's shocking.
I know it. Isn't it? It's so sad when the internet tells a lie.
Right.
So just to recap really quick, can you tell like when it was originally discovered? Are we going to go back over the history a little bit?
So we can, this actual item, there is good existence from 1354. Mm-hmm. We have good evidence that this exact thing. Now, if you listen to, it was a Tucker Carlson episode recently where he interviewed a guy who's an alleged expert on the Shroud. And man, he was throwing out all kinds of things. He was like, man, this was out in the 300s. We have evidence like it's referenced in the 300s AD. Now, so you'll know he's referencing something that is not the same thing. Like he's referencing something that's referenced by Eusebius, and what Eusebius is referencing in the 300s is a face covering only. Mm. Now, could it potentially be the Shroud of Turin folded up perfectly so that it only showed a face? I mean, okay. I guess, but okay. Man, that would be really weird for it to be given a totally different name. Is it somehow connected to this? Maybe, but I mean, that guy was very much so saying, we have documented evidence of the Shroud of Turin from the 300s, and that's not accurate.
What is Turin?
Mm-hmm. A place.
Oh, okay.
It's where it was discovered.
Oh, great. Yeah. That makes sense.
Which it wasn't discovered in Turin, right? It was discovered like a few cities. There were.
You may know more about that. Yeah.
And then ended up in Turin, I think.
Yeah, that's kind of where it was. It's where it spent a lot of time, maybe, is the way to say
and
it.
So then you start to uncover things about it. Interesting.
Yes. So okay. In 1354, we know it existed. And in 1389, a bishop denounced it as a forgery, claiming that an artist had created it. And Pope Clement VII, according to my notes, declared it not authentic then. So then from 1453... a private owner had it. So it was just a part of someone's art collection from 1453 until 1983. Now it was stored in 1683. Whoa. It was put into a chapel, but it was still owned by the private owners. It was put into a special chapel where people could go, I guess, kind of venerate it-ish, look at it. And it's been in that chapel since 1683. So that's how far back it goes. In 1898 is when the photos were released. Now, here's what's really fascinating about the Shroud of Turin. It is not super impressive as it is. What made it impressive was in 1898 when the photo negatives were released, and the photo negatives are impressive. They look the really cool. Yes. Mm-hmm. So again, we're not a visual podcast. So if you're listening, I recommend that you
Google
like, pause, look up, and go back and look at some of the original, like especially some of the original photo negatives and that kind of stuff. So that's the story of the Shroud of Turin. Is it was originally unpacked. It was acknowledged as existing in the 1300s. Almost immediately declared a piece of art, not a shroud that laid over Jesus's body.
Wow.
And then that's how it stayed. Then, but people continue to go like, but what is it though? And it seems awfully, how would they have made this in the 1300s? And it's like, it seems so weirdly authentic, and all these different questions are coming up. And so finally, in the 1970s and 80s, there was a series of tests done on it. And the series of tests came back very inconclusive, very controversial, except for one thing, and that is that the piece of fabric they cut from it was only a few hundred years old. So they cut a tiny, tiny little sliver of fabric, and they tested it, and it was only a few hundred years old. It was not 2,000 years old. Mm-hmm. Bummer. Okay. Well, turns out, you know, it's fun to look at, but it's only a couple of hundred years old. Now, if you go back and look at the section that they cut in order to carbon date it, this is what's wild, and this is what makes the conspiracy thing stand up on your neck a little bit, is anyone can see it's a patch. They clearly cut a piece of patch off of it and then carbon dated the patch. Well, we know it was damaged in a fire and patched. And so they know that, like that was done in the 1200s, that they know it was damaged in a fire and patched. And so how any serious scientist would go in and cut a piece of, again, I think any of us could look at it and go, well, that part's a patch and that part's a patch. And that's a piece they cut as a piece of the patch. And later when they came back and said, this is the, like they hid for a long time, or at least did not report on what section they cut. And when they finally came back and did say what section they cut, it was like, well, anybody can see that's a patch. Like, no. And so anyway, that started a whole new series of, in the last about 10 years, a whole series of, okay, now let's start checking this thing out.
Wow.
Is it real? Is it legit? Was there some conspiracy to cover up what it was? All that kind of stuff. So that's where we are now. And in fact, the piece they cut, so this is linen. Linen can last almost forever. We have 4,000-year-old pieces of linen.
Wow.
So linen can survive almost forever, apparently, which is wild. This piece that they cut, they came back and said, and apparent part of the report apparently was that it was cotton. It was cotton maybe with linen blend. Well, none of the rest of this thing is anything but linen. And so, again, why would that be allowed is kind of wild to me. Mm-hmm. Good. Wait, what else you got?
Is there any other linen from the first century that has remained? Like, are there any other than the things that...
Yes. Yeah, there is okay. ancient. There are other... So this is one of the things. So let's see if I can find the exact... Mm-hmm. I want to make sure I use the correct words. Well, shoot. It has to do with... There's a chemical that apparently has kind of a half-life in linen.
Interesting.
And... Wow. Linen loses this chemical. I don't think I have it on here. Again, now we're going to put the explicit on there. Oh, no, there it is. Vanillin is what they called it. And I may be spelling that correctly. Vanillin, I think, is what it's called. And that decays slowly in linen. This one has the same amount of... Vanillin. I may be saying it incorrectly. I'm going to feel really dumb about how I'm saying it. Sorry, I did this research like a month ago, and so now I can't remember
all
the
good
pronunciation. But that it decays out of it, and this has decayed the same amount as other linen from around 2,000-ish years ago.
Wow.
And so there's a good reason to think that it probably is. Now, they've also done wide-angle x-rays. They've done several other tests on it. And all of them are coming back first century. Mm. So that the linen itself is from the first century.
Yeah, if you look, even just a quick Google search there, I mean, there is some ancient Egyptian stuff that's even older than that. That is linen.
Well, but Egyptian stuff, people argue that only preserves because it's been entombed, like, you know, in the desert or in a pyramid. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's a good
point. Like, I've heard people say that first century and first century Egyptian are different.
Yeah, that would, obviously that would play a role in it.
Okay, my initial question, and we can talk about resources later, but I think this is frustrating because it is like other, there's nothing like this. It's not like other things.
Right.
It is like other things in that they're very like diametrically opposed views on it. So you hear some people and they're like, there's no evidence. They haven't tested this. You know, like I listened to a podcast about this and they were like, there's not, and it was a very well-known podcast. And they were like, there hasn't been any recent testing done. There hasn't been access granted to do deep testing on it. There's basically no good reason to think that it's first century. But then you have people that go to the other extreme where they're like, this is for sure the burial cloth of Jesus. Like this is what the Christian faith hangs on. And so I think just as an initial comment, and we can kind of touch on it as we go, but I think that is hard about something like this, where it's like, this is really cool to study. It's hard to find whatever information you find could be very different. And so I think, and I obviously I trust your research and your like, that is an expertise of yours of digging for truth. But I think it'd be helpful to talk about, at least at the end, for listeners of like how, when it's something like this that isn't an everyday thing for a lot of people to study, how do you go about knowing which source is accurate? Because I have heard a lot of different views on this, and I think that can be frustrating for people because they're like, well, which is it? You know what I mean?
Yes. So there's a few things. There's a couple of great rules to look at we can actually comment on now. Mm-hmm. One is you really want to see what the opinions of skeptics are. That's a really helpful one. When you've got someone who is absolutely convinced of something, then their input is going to need to be traced back. And so, and then anytime somebody gives any evidence that goes kind of against what you would predict their agenda would say, that's probably going to be pretty good information. Mm-hmm. And then you want information that's verifiable, like it is verifiable what Eusebius actually wrote from the 300s. Like we can go back and look at that and see that. So it's verifiable on that kind of thing. I think if you can find, and then specific people who attach their name to it, this is one of the issues that we deal with. It's your yawning thing again.
I'm not. I'm just tired. I woke up really early.
He's got you. We all understand. This is that great on mic. Oh my gosh. Something terrified Coulson. No, it's okay. He's just sleeping.
I'm over here watching Mr. Frost.
Yeah, exactly. Pre-podcast conversation. So for example, when you have a criminologist, so why would I listen to this person? You want to find someone who might actually know what they're talking about. And so, you know, there was a gentleman who was a criminologist who apparently went and studied it and found trace pollen spores and that kind of stuff on the cloth. And was able to trace like where these pollen spores would be from. There's dirt that's been found on it. And so they can like, there's good things to look at to go like these are, and you just want people to have a rational interpretation of their own data. Mm-hmm. And so when you've got someone rabidly agenda driven, and I don't remember the guy's name, like the guy who I saw interviewed on Carlson. I mean, all it took was a little bit of a background search to go, okay, no, that's not. That's what he's presenting there is not accepted and is at least edgy to say it's been referenced since the 300s. It's like, no, items similar to it have been referenced to the 300s, but there's no evidence at all that this shroud was referenced any further back than the 1300s. Mm. Again, that does not mean it's not legit. It is impressive. It clearly is representing somebody who's been beaten and is bloody. And had a crown of thorns on their head and probably is from first century. And now it from a piece of linen that's that old. And there's this weird way in which it has been somehow, this image has been kind of flashed onto this linen. It's super shallow. It would be very difficult to recreate today, very difficult to fake today. How would someone have faked in the 1300s? Well, I mean, we don't know if they pulled it off. It clearly is meant to represent someone, a burial shroud of someone crucified in the Roman era. It's clearly meant to represent that. The question is it a shroud used to over a body crucified during the Roman era, or is it somehow a creation of humans to represent that? And it is very difficult, and I think this is legit, it is very difficult to imagine how someone could pull it off the way it's done. Now, for example, that one of the guys I was listening to made a big deal about, oh, we know the type of blood, like they were able to blood test the blood. And the guy actually said, and it clearly is, you know, this type of blood, which is really common among Jews and from the first century, well, there is no such blood type that is somehow more common among Jews in the first century. That's just an invention.
Yeah, well, how do you get, were they testing the blood back then?
Yeah, I don't, like, that's what's weird is how would they know right. that? Is it common among, or he even says at one point, well, it's common among Jews today, and that's an easy search. It's not any more common among Jews today than other blood types are.
Interesting.
And so whether it was an error he's making about the ancient blood type, or whether it's an error that he's making about modern blood types, either way, it's an error.
Oh my gosh.
so that kind of stuff, you have to just, like, especially when it preaches really well, when it really fits, you always want to check that.
Okay.
And so to be skeptical about it, because here's what's sad to me. There's enough evidence here that it is a first century burial shroud that making up evidence at this point only hurts your case.
Yeah.
Or exaggerating evidence only hurts your case. It apparently is not, according to including some scientific, you know, researchers, it doesn't seem to be paint, dye, or pigment.
So it's not some, like, a regular medium.
It doesn't look like somebody charcoal colored it. It doesn't look like it's paint in any way. It's not, it's very, very thin, like 0.2 microns.
Wow.
Which would be super hard for people to recreate on linen without it soaking, whatever medium you use, soaking further than that through the linen.
Mm-hmm. So is there a guess as to how, like, if it was a burial shroud and is there any guess into how it was imprinted with an image? Like if it's actually...
Other than the person who was buried under it being resurrected through it? No, not really.
Interesting.
So that's the idea, is that this shroud, someone, it looks like this body came potentially like someone did a flash photography, like a nuclear, you know how a nuclear explosion creates a shadow of, like, they find shadows of people on buildings, that it's like something burned into the fabric, but only this depth, like flash photography. Or something like that.
Oh, I hadn't heard that part. Yeah. That's so interesting.
And so that's the idea, is that no, just laying over what for me as a kid, even when I first saw it and learned about it a little bit, it was like, oh, that's cool. The blood soaked in. And by the way, the blood is soaked all the way in. So the blood does soak all the way in. It's the after image that isn't. It's the image of the person under it that isn't. So the blood is what you would expect from a body that a linen cloth was laid over a bloody beaten body. That's what you would expect. And it even has like the guy's list when they have people look at it and go through it, like, okay, this is someone who clearly was wearing a crown of thorns. He had hundreds of tiny little wounds around his head. He had hundreds of wounds around his upper body and his back, his upper torso and his back. He had a gaping wound on his side, on one of his sides. And he had large wounds on his wrists and ankles. And so it's kind of like, I mean, now we do now know, by the way, if there is some other explanation, we do now know that the crown of thorns may not have been unique to Jesus. We now know, because of the game of kings that Roman soldiers played with Roman prisoners. Mm. That may have been actually a relatively common experience. They may have hammered crowns of thorns onto many people, but we don't know that. But we now have that. We found those evidence of the game of kings that Roman soldiers apparently played with criminals to be executed. So it may be that that's not that unique. That them treating Jesus as a king may not have been unique. Or as some people say, maybe Jesus was the first.
And maybe they could.
That they were like, hey, that was fun. Let's do that with all the crucified. Anyway, so.
Like the Roman.
Yeah, just that would be a very Roman thing to do. Hey, you know what? Torturing that person, that was kind of a unique experience. We ought to do that every time. So there are, they have things like there's dirt from the feet areas and the knee areas and the elbow areas, as if this person had fallen recently before the shroud was used to cover him. So there's all kinds of fascinating little thing that are
which
here.
Is crazy that all can be preserved for
yes
that long in a garment in a yes. piece of fabric.
And except for the okay. fire, it has been relatively well protected. Yes.
I do have a question. I'm playing devil's advocate, but
good.
What do you think when was it Joseph of Arimathea that buried him?
Mm-hmm.
Or,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Wouldn't they have washed? I mean, he the wound still would have been bleeding, but wouldn't he have washed the body, or was it too mangled? Do you think he just buried him?
So like, here's what's interesting. It does seem like we could look up and see if the Bible references, but very many people remember that the women are going back to the tomb Sunday morning to prepare the body for burial. And so even though they buried it on Friday, because it was right before Sabbath,
oh, right.
they might not have had the opportunity. I think that's an easy search to see if the Bible ever references. Mm-hmm. I will do that real quick. Because I do not remember if the Bible references them washing the body. Obviously, they wrapped
because
it.
Because it seems kind of hasty. Like, okay, well, we're going to put the body in the tomb.
Yeah. Did anyone wash Jesus?
I mean, it talks about the timing because Sabbath was coming, right?
Yes. No, it was wrapped with burial spices. And John does not mention washing the body. What it says in every one of them is Joseph buys in Mark 15, Joseph buys a linen shroud, takes the body down, wraps it, and places it in a tomb. Matthew 27, wrapped in a clean linen, no washing mentioned. Luke 23, no washing is described as that. It implies that when the women returned after the Sabbath, they were going to prepare the body correctly, that it was until then incomplete. So you would normally wash the body, anoint it, and then wrap it in linen. So the idea being that there was no time for washing. So the short answer is that no, the Gospels apparently do not record Jesus' body being washed before his burial.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Interesting.
Wow. Which again would be odd because normally a Jewish body would be washed before burial. So here's, to me, this is a fascinating, this one's always interesting to me. I don't know when this issue, filmmaker David Rolfe issued a $1 million challenge for anyone to recreate the process of the Shroud of Turin. And it has been attempted many, many times with no success. So no one has been able to recreate how it was done, even though there's $1 million on the line for it.
Wow.
And though we have a lot more technology than
they did
the 1300s, obviously. Yes.
So there you go. It's fascinating. What would it mean if we were able to know with absolute certainty that this was the burial shroud of Jesus of Nazareth? I don't know. I don't know that it would change anything for hardly anybody. Would there be anyone convert? The danger for me would be that it bears his blood, and therefore you would have millions of people around the world who would want to worship it. In the same way that in the Roman Catholic world, they worship the actual communion items, the elements, because they believe it becomes the body and blood of Jesus actually. And so they worship that because it is the body and blood of Jesus. So that to me is like, that would concern me. If it became absolutely convinced, I think people would worship the shroud because it bears the potential of the flesh and blood of Jesus.
Just like any relic or anything like that.
So now most relics aren't, we can talk about relics for a minute. They're not going to be worshiped.
Yeah.
because they don't have any parts of Jesus. Like that's, they only worship things if it's correctly worshiped. I mean, people worship junk all the time,
right? But
like correctly, it's only appropriate to worship something if it is Jesus or if it is God, which in their theology, in the Roman Catholic theology, obviously the bread and the wine literally become the body of yes. Jesus. And so they worship it.
Transubstantiation.
Yeah. And so, different perspectives of different people along that line. But, anyway, so this is a, I think that would be, it would be wild. I think it would be interesting. Just the fact that even if it's just is a first century shroud, even to show this is the way this was done in the first century would be archaeologically incredibly significant. The idea of them driving a spear into the side of a crucified victim to verify his death. Even if this isn't Jesus, even if this is, you know, Larry of Cana who got, you know, murdered by the Romans, it would still be very archaeologically very significant to know.
VeggieTales?
Exactly. And so he you know, the fact that they did crowns of thorns and that they drove spears into people's sides would still be significant, obviously, and crucified them this way. But the idea of it actually being Jesus is intriguing only because it would imply that something supernatural happened between his body and this linen cloth. And that is the real significance of this is, obviously there's archaeological significance if it's ancient, but then the question is, how did this image get flash printed onto it? In something that we would have a very difficult time recreating now, the energy it would require to flash burn a piece of linen only 0.2 microns deep would be amazing. For someone to do that now would be really hard. How would that possibly have been done back then is really wild to consider. I do feel like there's only so far we can take this as far as proof goes. I think we're probably, unless and the Catholic Church is not likely to give people the freedom to go back in and cut a piece off of the actual shroud, it's like to do further data on it, further analysis on it, to gather further data on it. I don't know that the Roman Catholic Church is going to allow anything that even potentially would damage it, even the tiniest part of it. So especially if they begin to accept it as a relic or more, then I think we're stuck probably with no one else getting their hands on it ever again. So,
well, I disagree a little bit that it wouldn't change anything for some people, because I do think people want like tangible, like I can hold in my hand evidence that Jesus was a person. And so I think for some people, if enough sources came out and said, this is for sure that, I think it could impact people's faith because it impacts some people now and there's not that type of evidence. And so, but like you're saying, I think there's a danger in it being worshipped. There's also the danger in like, if all of your faith hinges on this one cloth being evidence of Jesus and isn't more holistic and, nuanced than that, like, then what happens if, you know, 20 years later, then it comes out again that it's fake? What does that mean for your faith?
Right.
If that's all that it hinges on. So I do think a lot of people, and understandable, I think a lot of people would want, that's appealing, having a tangible evidence of like, look, Jesus was a person, he, you know, was killed in this way. Like, I think that would be helpful for some people, but I think you're right that there's a danger to even that level of certainty.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that we'll get more than we have now.
Yeah.
And so I think it could be a faith booster for people who like Brandon's saying, who like the evidence of it. Honestly, if you're doubting the evidence that there ever was a person named Jesus of Nazareth, it would be, I don't know that any amount of evidence, because the evidence already is so overwhelming that there was such a person. It's much better than almost anyone else in history, certainly past a few hundred years back. Yeah, I think it would be cool. That's a good point. I think for some people, it would be an easy way to say, okay, at least this claim was real. And now there's a really cool mystery surrounding what happened to his body. That would be cool. I don't know that we'll ever get that. I don't know that we'll ever get more sure than we are right now. Now, if they could get a piece of the blood nowadays, could you clone him? Like, could you get at least discover his genome? Because I'd be interested to know what a man who was born without a dad, what his genome looks like. Like that would be,
That's
I've always wondered about that. Like how does, what do his genes look like? But I feel like there's a lot of opportunities for this to be nothing more than it is, which is a curiosity.
Yeah.
I think it could be more than that. I don't know that it'll ever be less than that. Like it's either a curiosity from the 1300s, which is cool. That's fascinating. Fun to dig into, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or it is more than that. So sure, I'm happy for it to be more than that. More archaeological evidence is good.
Go ahead. I found a quote from Wes Huff about the like archaeology based on, it was a conversation around the Shroud of Turin, but I thought it was really good. If you don't know who Wes Huff is,
mm-hmm.
He has tons of content, but he's an apologist and he specializes in the history of ancient biblical manuscripts, but very, we covered him in a couple of episodes ago last year sometime. But anyway, his quote on archaeology was, "Sometimes I see people online using archaeology as a silver bullet proof text because we found city A and it's also mentioned in the Bible, then story A in the Bible is obviously true. And I don't think that's the point of archaeology. The point is to incorporate collaborative data that ultimately points to the general reliability of the biblical stories."
Mm-hmm.
Like basically saying the more that we find, it's not like, oh, because we found this one thing, therefore all of the Bible's true. It's like, no, all of the collection of information and data and archaeological finds all point to these stories being true and accurate. It's not that there's one that you can hang your whole faith on because,
right. You know.
Anyway, I thought that was a good point. Because we treat, you know, we've talked about archaeology before and we often, I think maybe out of fear sometimes we're like, okay, well, this is it. Now no one can ever disprove. And it's like, that's not, you know, that's not how these conversations work.
Yeah, I think that's a good way, probably a better way, the way he's saying it, of engaging with these archaeological, it is wild when these things of archaeological evidence come forward and they can be encouraging to us, supporting to us, you know, and it happens over and over again. I mean, over and over again, we find something and it's like, oh, yep, that's what the Bible said it would be. And I think that's one of those things is like really cool that we get to do that, that we get to engage in that conversation, that our faith is consistently supported, that big questions, you know, there are no such people as the Hittites. Their Pontius Pilate is a biblically fictional character. And I'm overstating that there aren't many people who went that far with it, but there were some people who were pushing those. And then you find something like, oh no, a Hittite's real thing. And oh, here's a giant rock with Pontius Pilate's name on it, honoring him. And so it's like, these are for sure. It is great when those are there, but I think what you're saying, Brent, is right. And from Wes is those cannot be the foundation of your faith. Because there's always going to be new stuff being discovered. And it, sometimes when it is discovered, it's like, is this, isn't it? What is it? What isn't it? And you just have to be careful with it all. And if you're too desperate for it, then you end up buying into all types of cons. And that's what we've talked about. You know, one of the things we talked about were relics. What were you going to say, Bryn?
Oh, I was going to say, well, the funny thing to me about this is I was fully expecting, because none of us have talked about it together before now. We've like done our own research. But I was fully expecting to come in and Chris be like, yeah, but because you're such a skeptic. And
yeah, so exactly.
You're like, actually, this is really interesting. And I'm like, wait, what? that alone, it kind of goes back to your like, find sources that, you know, they haven't already made up their mind about things because that's more reliable. And that's like, that was how I felt about today. I was like, oh.
Oh, wow.
Chris even thinks there's something to this. I'm. Like that alone is funny to me because I'm like, oh, okay. Well,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's a good, anytime you've got someone who you know is hesitant and skeptical and is like, whatever. But I am now, I think there's good reason to think that at least the linen is from the first century and that it does represent someone who was crucified under Roman rule and probably in and around Jerusalem. And I don't think we have an explanation for why if it was just the blood and everything else, it would be really, really cool to me to go, this is a really cool archaeological find that shows crown of thorns, someone who's been scourged, someone who's been crucified, someone who's had a spear thrust in their side. That to me would be phenomenally cool information. The flashed, whatever the image is that is only visible really through the photo negative, not through the original, just our own eyes, we can barely see it if you look at it yourselves. But then once the negative is presented, you're like, oh, there's, wow, that's wild. It is also a little weird, and this is what gets me, it is a little weird that it looks kind of like the Jesus that we have portrayed in art.
Right, right.
That it's like, did people believe in this enough that when they painted Jesus, they kind of followed? Right. Even maybe extra weird is that the guy playing Jesus now in The Chosen, like, this is about the right height and the hair length. Like, Jewish men didn't wear long hair typically, and yet this guy had apparently some long-ish hair, it seems. And so it's like, but wait, what?
Go both ways. It's like, did the art come from this, or was it like that? If it was created in the 1300s for some reason,
of course,
like,
they would have.
That's because that's what art looked like then.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
man.
Anyway, it's just fun. To me, it's really fun, and it's great to engage with. And anyway, I think it's really a cool. It's a cool conversation, a cool study, and it's fun to dive into. My faith in Christ and what it means. Yeah, absolutely. But my faith in Christ was in no way affected by this.
Yeah.
One way it was or the other is like, I mean, that's really cool. If it's real, man, that's amazing. And if it's not, like, okay, that doesn't change the roots of our faith.
It'd be one thing if in the Bible it said, like,
2,000-year-old burial cloth, Jesus never died.
Right. Well, but it's like, in the Bible, it references the shroud found in Turin, Italy.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't.
No, it does say a shroud, and it does say linen.
True.
It does say those, but anyway, yeah. Okay. Okay. You said you had one more, Bryn. You were like, we got to talk before we take a break.
This is like cycling back, or this is full circle back to your first comment, but you were talking about how things kind of go in cycles of like every, 15, 20 years, things are like rediscovered.
Yes.
Why do you think that is? Is it because kind of generationally people, like the next generation, becomes the age where they're looking into these things and they have to discover things again for themselves? Do you think that it's people bring them back around intentionally because they know that it'll create a hype because people have kind of forgotten about it? Like, what do you have a theory on why that is a cycle?
So part of my answer is yes, I do think some people do it because it is valuable to do it. Like there's a financial, rediscovery fee that we get. Oh, we get to be the one who does the big special on the Gospel of Philip or the Gospel of Judas or the Gospel of Mary. Like, oh, look at this. And it is agenda driven in that it's never presented as, okay, so here's something that some random person wrote 200 years after the life and times of Jesus, claiming to be written by one of his disciples. No one thinks it was written by Philip. No one believes that for a second. We all know the truth of the matter is that it was not written by one of Jesus's followers. It was written 200 years later. It does not back with the things that we have written from the first century. There's no universe in which it should have been added into the canon, but it's kind of cool. That would be great. I'd be all about that. Like, that's how I feel about them. I like looking at them and seeing them and reading them and going like, look at that. That's cool. That's how people thought about this or whatever. I think that's fascinating. But what I hate is they come forward and say, those Christians were keeping anyone who disagreed with them out of the gospel. Like the Bible is just edited so that it only includes people
who
believe.
Can you believe the Council of Nicaea left this out?
Exactly. They just invented Christianity, the Council of Nicaea. Like this type of, it's just like the dumbest stuff.
Historical Weather Channel. It's like,
funny.
You know what I mean? It's like. The history version of the Weather Channel where they're like, there's for sure going to be a tornado. And you're like, wait, it's November. What?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it is and now here's what I will tell you. I don't know how much of it is agenda driven as in like there's people with calendars that's like, hey, it's now been 25 years since we mentioned the Gospel of Philip. We need to rediscover it. And show how Jesus and Mary Magdalene actually had a sexual relationship. And here's how we know it. And like, I don't know that it's necessarily that. I actually think that part of it is, yes, there is that behind the scenes, maybe even demonically. But I also think most people in media aren't very well educated about the whole world. And so they know so a little like bit about their one area. Yeah. And so what happens is they discover it and they're just prideful enough to believe they're the ones to get that. Like, I look at what I uncovered and they don't even necessarily do the research to realize, no, this was being talked about just 25 years ago. And 25 years before that, and 25 years before
now
that.
Now I'm going to put a really good soundtrack to it and a monologue, and it's going to...
Yeah, I'm going to write a book, and it's going to be a shocking revelation of how all these different hidden things in Christianity and the fact that there really is a direct descendant of Jesus and Mary Magdalene living somewhere a la Dan Brown. And he made millions and millions writing... What was the name of that book? The Da Vinci Code?
Yeah. And
in the beginning of it said, everything in this book is based in reality. Like, yes, the story is fictional, but every piece of information that I put, every bit of data is right. And he says that, and it's just not, like, it took me, this is, the internet was brand new when this came out. And I was like, took me time to discover just error after error.
And then Lee Strobel came out with a whole video series debunking the Da Vinci Code because people were so excited about, or, you know, there was so much hype around it. He released a whole video series like, no, but like, let's dig into it.
That is really interesting.
I remember I knew Dan, how I was going to take Dan Brown's stuff when I was reading his book and he starts by talking about how the Louvre has 666 glass panes in the pyramid above and how that's an intentional reference to the number of the beast. And I went online and just searched how many glass panes are in the Louvre. Mm. And it was 674.
Nice.
Here we go. This is going to be so fun. Like even the most basic piece of information he may just be it up.
To me, that is so funny. It's like, really? You couldn't have researched that for the book?
Well, I figure he did.
He just made it up.
Yeah, exactly. He's just like, yeah, but you know what would sound cool?
As if we did this.
The internet wasn't what it is today. He didn't think people would go and research it themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway,
but
I just
to say there are some people who probably think, like you're saying, that they have discovered new information and are trying to get it out to the public for whatever their motivation, only they know that. But kind of points to our conversation that we keep coming back to of like, don't fear when something new comes out and there's a huge buzz around it. Like, just, you know, take a deep breath and then proceed.
Wow. Yes. Yep. Let's not do the Christian panic thing that we've seen so many times. Not on this. Now, we're about to, in a moment, you know, come back and maybe even just discuss for a minute what Christians do need to be thinking about and planning for and responding to in a healthier way. So, I don't know if we were going to take a little,
Let's take a little break,
a little commercial break, and we'll be right back.
Here we go. Yeah. Now we're back. We're back.
For you is nothing.
Yeah.
Listeners.
It's like going to sleep. It's like getting a colonoscopy.
That's wow.
Nope. It's not like that.
Kind of.
I mean, could be. Yeah, as far as you know, right? Exactly. It's,
yeah,
you go to sleep and
maybe I should stop.
I don't know.
I'll stop the comedy thing.
No, please don't. I just have to always, you know, I always have to comment on your comedy.
I need it. I need the commentary.
That's right.
Well, so, you know,
this is kind of a more serious.
Yeah,
problem
this is more serious.
Although let's comment. Bryn, you said this, it's like, okay, we have to talk about this. It feels like every 6 months or something.
Yes, literally. I feel like we've either done so many of these episodes or we have talked about it and been like, well, we just covered something very similar.
Yeah, a fall from grace or somebody passes away and when they, a church leader makes a mistake and it's not just I slipped up. It's like, knowingly living in sin.
Yeah.
For years and then it comes out. And so the most recent one is Philip Yancey.
Yep.
Do you want to unpack a little bit of that, Chris?
Well, it's just it's heartbreaking, but it is becoming, and I don't think this is new. I don't think we've discovered something.
Right.
I think it turns out that humans are super, super frail and prone to sin.
Being
famous, well-known, well-published, even saying brilliant things does not protect you from this. And it does not protect you from sin or falling into sin. Knowing exactly how to avoid this kind of sin apparently does not protect you from sin. I will tell you my first thought with a group of guys when someone shared this with me and we looked it up, and I was like, are you kidding me? And then I thought, apparently I'm never safe from myself. And so, you know, I'm in my 50s and I kind of have this probably false impression that's like, hey, I've probably faced the biggest temptations I'm going to face to be unfaithful in my marriage already, and have made it through and did not cheat on my wife. And then to hear more and more of these examples of you know,
older
people. Seems like men mostly, but I'm sure that's part of, that's just the statistics of it. But is these men who in their 60s and 70s and et cetera, that's when they start their unfaithful behavior, as far as we know. I mean, now part of it is what we know is that Philip Yancey has come out and said that he has been having an affair for 8 years, knowingly, like intentionally pursued this, having an affair for 8 years, and he is 78. And so somewhere around 70, apparently he started the affair. Now, if there were others, we don't know. If there were other situations before that, like obviously he's not come out and said, here's the entire history of my marriage. And he did not, I don't think he said in the article, I actually was looking it up to see if he said it. I don't think he actually said, like, other than this, I have been faithful to my marriage. And so I don't know that you would say that, but I don't think he did say that. And so is that the case? I just don't, I don't know the whole story.
Like, were there other patterns? You don't know.
Yeah, exactly. And but so I don't know.
You said that you were going to mention something else because we saw somebody. I mean, if your algorithm on social media is anything like mine, and I'm not going and looking for it, there's all sorts of comments and people saying all sorts of things of he needs this person to feed him and change his diapers soon and all this stuff.
I am intrigued by the fact, and again, I don't know the man.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on with him. I don't know his story. I know that in 2023, he came out with the fact that he had Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm.
I do know Parkinson's disease can have intense psychological effects on people, and sometimes they make decisions they wouldn't otherwise make. But I also know, as someone pointed out, so in 2023, which obviously is only 3 years ago, 2 to 3 years ago. So he had been having the affair a long time before he came into the public light and said, I have Parkinson's. He did not in 2023 say, I've just been diagnosed with Parkinson's and I've been having an affair for 5 years. Like that would have been a time to come forward with his sin. If he, you know, at any point along the way is the right time to acknowledge and repent. But as someone pointed out, you know, his wife is sticking with him. She's going to stick with him. And his statement was beautiful. I mean, considering the position of brokenness, he does not make excuses. He does not defray blame. He 100% owns it, which is, again, you're like, good. That's
par for the course, which you hope for.
Well, sadly, it should be what we get every time. And it isn't what we get every time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so that's good. His wife's response, gracious, loving, I made a commitment, I'm sticking with it, et cetera. Again, very beautiful. And she seems to be even kind of acknowledging, like, I'm not required to stay, but I made the commitment to stay, so I'm going to. And if it's legit, if he's authentically penitent, then it's totally fine and appropriate, obviously, for her to stay if she chooses to. That's her calling between her and God. What someone pointed out was, it is, this person was questioning kind of, I think, the convenience of, he's come forward to acknowledge an affair, his wife is going to stick with him, and he is starting the debilitating path of Parkinson's. And so is it possible, this person I think was kind of positing, like, did his paramour was his paramour, his affair partner, like, yeah, I'm not interested in having an affair with someone I'm going to have to change their diapers. Meanwhile, his wife is saying, I will stick with you. And so I think the person, it seemed to me like, and not in a weird way, the person was kind of expressing their frustration and kind of dubious attitude about, you know, I don't trust him, which I think he's given us all good reason not to trust him. Mm. And so she's like, I don't trust him. I don't trust his motives. Is the only reason he's staying with his wife at this point is because this is the situation.
So like in any of these situations, you know, sometimes you have people who are a famous speaker or something like that. Other people who have really loved his writing. He's a fantastic writer. What do you do? What does your mind do then with, you know, I think about somebody who writes music and then they have been living a life of sin. Do you stop listening to that music? Is that piece of art or work that they devoted themselves to, does that negate that? You know what I mean? So it's like, well, you shouldn't read his books anymore and his books aren't true because of this mistake that he made or whatever. Like, how do you, because I think there are those types of things that people, obviously, we should deconstruct our faith in humanity.
Right. Yes.
But I just think of like somebody preaches a great sermon or a great series of sermons or a great decades of sermons.
Yeah.
And then they have a fall from grace. Does all of that, because the Lord uses that and has used it. So I don't know where does your mind go with, and maybe I'm just asking for your commentary, not this is what we should do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Are you asking me or Chris?
Both of y'all. I'm curious.
Yeah. Well, I have a couple of thoughts, especially because we have covered things that are sadly similar several times. And I think even more than that, we've had to process things like this a lot the last couple of years with Christian culture, which is kind of an interesting thing of like, why do we think this does seem to be happening more publicly in the last couple of years, which is kind of a different question we can touch on if we have time. But I think having to process through that a lot, one of the things that we have seen and I think is understandable, even in myself, is like your first reaction is discouragement. And your first reaction is like, oh, what does this mean about everything that they've taught? You know, does the gospel actually have power? If you say the gospel has power to do all this and then, you know, you're living a double life. Like, I think those questions are normal. But if anything, I think, like we've talked about over and over again, that's why it's important to acknowledge that we have to deconstruct our faith in humans because humans are so broken. And so it's more of like a testament that the gospel is true because it's like we have been saying all along that we're broken and God uses broken vessels and the point is him, not us. Mm-hmm. And yet it is still in our nature to want to elevate and follow people instead of Jesus. And so if anything, it's just proof of like, no, once again, we try to follow the Lord and we fail at that. And he is the point. Like he is the one.
Yeah.
And so, and we've talked about before how truth is not made, true by the bearer of that truth, unless that person is God. And so it's like, just because you're saying something that's true, like whether or not you're, you know, the bearer of the truth doesn't change it. Does that make sense?
That's
like,
exactly right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, but I think on a human level, I think just in myself, what has been hard is whenever you have something like this, it does put a distaste in your mouth. So other influencers or, you know, Christian pastors and people who've had a lot of impact, anytime I run across their work now or their sermons or their whatever, and you know what was happening while they were giving that talk or writing that book, it does put a distaste in my mouth. And I'm like, I believe like whatever's in this book or this sermon, but now it's like associated with that brokenness and that sadness of knowing what was happening. And I think, I think that can happen without discrediting everything they're talking about, just like the human emotion of it, of like, oh man, but I'm still reminded of this, you know, whenever I interact with their work. I don't know, those are kind of some initial thoughts, but
yeah.
Yeah.
What? I don't know. What
yeah, do I think that's certainly we... And we have talked about this. I think each time we run into this,
I feel like every time it comes up, this is a broken record.
Which, of course, is, I mean, yeah, it is very real. And it's a form of grief that we have to work through. I feel like, I think it was the Didache, but one of the very early church writings when they asked the question, is what makes something valuable, is it the message or the messenger? And they quickly decided it is the message. The truth value of the message is what matters, not the messenger. And I think you can imagine if you're someone like the Apostle Peter and you get asked that question, like, which one matters, Peter? Is it you that matters or is it your message that matters? I mean, he's going to be like, well, obviously the message. I mean, you wouldn't have to know Peter long. It's wild to me that people think it's weird if I go like, for years I read the Apostle Paul and just thought like, I don't think I would have liked him very much. Mm. I mean, I don't think he and I would have been hanging out. Now that I've read... what's his name?
N.T.
Wright's book on him. That's a little bit different in my heart, but for a long time, that was kind of my perspective was like, I don't, this doesn't seem like somebody I would enjoy their company. And which is irrelevant to the truth of what he says. And so all truth is God's truth, whether we, where it comes from is not what is relevant, that it is true. Now, of course, for us, it is, and for Yancey and his wife and his followers and his all these people, of course it impacts us. I mean, it'd be silly to say it doesn't impact us. Of course it does. What it doesn't impact is the truth value of what he wrote or claimed or taught or preached. But that's he still makes himself somewhat irrelevant with this, which is heartbreaking. I feel like Yancey had the potential to go down as being one of the most impactful writers of the 80s and 90s, especially in Christianity. And now what he will be remembered for is this. And how sad that to not protect one's own legacy. And I say that and then think, yeah, Chris, so don't mess this up. Like, I think any of us who think, well, I mean, yeah, I'm so above that. I would never sin like that. I would never buy into that. That's a terrible thing that I would never, it's beneath me. Well, that's probably how he got there, is that type of lie that he told himself. And so I feel like we need to be humbly engaging with the conversation. It is heartbreaking to me for Christianity to lose this voice and to have just yet another example that we have to engage with who it looked like they had essentially finished strong. And it turns out they had not. They had finished in secret. Their sin was hidden instead. And so it definitely caused all the guys who I was sitting around with, we were in a conversation to like, look each other in the eyes and I'm not cheating on my wife. How about you? Nope, not cheating on my wife. Like, okay, good. don't do that. And yeah, it's just sad. Man. There's no excuse. And that's part of it is it's not like there's an excuse. He understood.
Right.
So it's just very, very sad.
Man.
Okay. I look forward to sometime in the relatively near future. I know we've got some interviews coming up with there'll be some fascinating interviews. And then I also know, our plan is, I just heard this morning a little piece. I haven't even heard the whole thing, but Bart Ehrman, maybe one of the strongest, quote, opponents of modern Christianity, just gave what allegedly is his final lecture, his retirement lecture. I don't buy that for, I don't buy it for a second.
Clickbait. It's just clickbait.
Exactly.
It's all those YouTube videos of those guys who have like, they're like, oh my goodness, I can't believe I had to film my last video. Yeah. And people are like, oh my goodness, I get a bunch of views. They're like, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, you're doing another one next week. I think that is a... Like, I don't buy it. I think all that it is his retirement video. As all that this is his from retirement. Yeah, from the college. So,
yeah.
And so I am curious to see what he says in it.
Yeah.
The only thing I've heard so far is his answer to the question, like, what's the most important discovery in regards to the Bible, like, ever? And anyway... His answers were like, I got to talk about this. I don't care if no one listens. I've got to talk about some of these because they, I was really like, this is bad. And he knows better. This is what's sad to me is some of these, once again, he knows that what he's saying is not
what a
the
weird thing
picture.
To devote your life to though.
I agree.
You know,
that's literally what I was about to say.
Really?
Yeah.
For someone, for someone who says he doesn't believe in the Bible, he's devoted his whole life to like making sure people also don't believe in it. That's like a lot of energy for something that you don't think is true and matters.
Yeah. To me, that seems like spiritual warfare.
Yeah, it does.
I'm like, man, I just don't understand it. I scratch my head every time.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
I think so.
Well, thank you.
There you go.
Cool.
Well, see you next time.
All righty.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Reconstructed Faith. If you enjoyed what you heard or were challenged, please leave us a review. It'll help other people find us. If you have questions or a topic you'd like to hear discussed, shoot me an email at info@southspring.org. Reconstructed Faith is a resource of South Spring Baptist Church. Remember, don't give up, trust God, search for answers.